This is Rory Spiegel and Ryan Radecki, and this is the Annals of Emergency Medicine podcast. It is 2020, a brand new year, and we're back again for another great month of articles. Ryan, how you doing?
I am doing fantastic. I do not have coronavirus.
Not yet. It's early though. All right. Well, why don't we hop right in, because we got a lot to discuss. I wanted to start with a comment from a listener. He's actually a listener, and also his recent article was published in our December issue, and we discussed it. And he had some thoughts. And this is John Burkhart. He published the article entitled "Diversity in Emergency Medicine: Are We Supporting a Career Interest in Emergency Medicine for Everyone?" So after our podcast last month, this is Rory Spiegel and Ryan Radecki, and this is the Annals of Emergency Medicine podcast. It is 2020, a brand new year, and we're back again for another great month of articles. Ryan, how you doing?
I am doing fantastic. I do not have coronavirus.
Not yet. It's early though. All right. Well, why don't we hop right in, because we got a lot to discuss. I wanted to start with a comment from a listener. He's actually a listener, and also his recent article was published in our December issue, and we discussed it. And he had some thoughts. And this is John Burkhart. He published the article entitled "Diversity in Emergency Medicine: Are We Supporting a Career Interest in Emergency Medicine for Everyone?" So after our podcast last month, John had some concerns. He was concerned on the conversation seemed to focus on things other than what the current data suggests, which is a persistent and in some cases worsening lack of diversity in emergency medicine. And he wanted to make sure that we highlight this. And so I thought we could again discuss this shortly on the podcast. So John, we completely agree. I'm sorry that what our comments came across as less focusing on this and maybe talking about other topics. But yes, we agree that there is a what could be an existential crisis, that it seems that medical students going into emergency medicine are less diverse than the current population of medical school graduates. And your article and the rest of the issue was highlighting that problem. And I think going forward, we have to figure out how we can do better. But thank you for your comments.
All right, great. Closing the loop.
All right. Why don't we move on? And we'll start with our first article this month, which is 1 year mortality of patients after emergency department treatment for non-fatal opiate overdose. And the lead author is Scott Weiner. So we all know the current opioid crisis that we're currently existing in, but these authors hope to actually define how bad this crisis was. And they did so by determining the 1 year mortality of patients who were treated in the emergency department for an opiate overdose and discharge. And they looked at patients who were treated in Massachusetts emergency departments for suspected opiate overdose and subsequently discharge. They described both the 30-day and 1 year mortality rates of these patients. They conducted a retrospective analysis using a linked set of data combining a master's demographic list, an acute care hospital mixed database, and state death records. They included patients who were treated in the emergency department for opiate overdose according to the diagnosis code between July 1st, 2011 and September 30th, 2015. The primary outcome measure, like we said, was 1 year mortality and 30-day mortality. Between 2011 and 2015, there was a total of 17,241 patients treated for opiate overdose in Massachusetts emergency departments. Of these, about 11,000 were discharged from the ED and met inclusion criteria for this paper. Of the discharged patients, about 5.5% died within 1 year. Of those, about 1.3% died within 1 month, and 0.25 died within 2 days of their emergency department visit. The median age of these patients was 39 years old, and about 71% of them were men. Death records indicated that 67.4% of these deaths were opioid related. I mean, this is pretty tragic numbers. I mean, imagine this, 1 in 20 patients you see in the emergency department for a non-fatal overdose will be dead with 1 year. That is somewhat shocking, though. I guess it does highlight what we already know about the opiate epidemic, but it does speak to the importance of the take-home naloxone kits and the medical assisted therapy and how important these are to get them started on patients when we see them in the ED.
It's a pretty good summary, Rory. And interestingly enough, we have another article from this same issue dealing with almost the same topic, but a different database. This one is entitled 1 Year Mortality After Emergency Department Visit for Non-Fatal Opioid Poisoning, a Population-Based Analysis. Lead author here is Pamela Lease, and they are coming from the Health Promotion, Chronic Disease, and Injury Prevention Public Health Ontario. This is a linked healthcare database in, as you'd imagine, Ontario, Canada, with opioid poisoning and subsequent mortality data gathered during calendar years 2015 and 2016. Their data set consists of 6,140 patients who attended an emergency department for non-fatal opioid poisoning, of which there were 327 deaths within 1 year, and 118 of those could be attributed to subsequent opioid overdose. This is pretty consistent with the rate observed in the previous article. Again, 5.3% dying of any cause and 2% dying of opioid-related causes. Demographics gathered included age, urban and rural locations, acuity, means of overdose, initial disposition, and other mental health or substance use diagnoses, as well as subsequent health service use. They did not have terribly insightful characteristics associated with their opioid-related mortality, low numbers of patients with any specific associated features, and most of their confidence intervals crossed unity. Men, those using, interestingly, opioid agonist therapy, and those also prescribed benzodiazepines were at higher risk for death. But that doesn't imply that these are necessarily inappropriate or causative, but they were predicted death when observed in association. So, pretty similar to what we'll see in the other articles presented here today. Elevated risk based on many features, but again, small absolute elevated risks.
Yeah, I think it's telling that both these articles are pretty consistent with the 1 year mortalities. And, you know, obviously they both have their limitations and they're all based off what patients were actually coded for opioid overdose in the emergency department. So it doesn't count patients that overdosed pre-hospital and got pre-hospital Narcan or something like that and never made it to the emergency department, or they had a code for something else in the emergency department. So some patients might be missed. Obviously using death records, you don't always catch everybody. And it's not always that accurate what they died from. So the rate of opioid-related deaths are slightly different in these two articles. And that might simply be due to the fact that it's hard to, death records are notoriously unreliable of what people actually died from. That being said, I think it's pretty consistent that the one-year mortalities are pretty similar between these two, and obviously higher than we would like.
Oh, yeah. And that's why there's two articles like this in here, because the redundancy and the it's like a replication, essentially. Methods are different. The databases are different. The coding is different. But then, you know, death itself is the death is definitely 100%. There's no ambiguity over whether a person is alive or dead, despite the question about what their cause of death may or may not have been. So right. Seeing that kind of consistency helps us make sure that helps us verify the scope of the problem.
It's also telling that, you know, one was an American cohort and the other was a Canadian cohort. So this, you know, this crisis has hit North America equally badly throughout.
You mean our 51st state to the north?
Oh, we're going to get some complaints now, Ryan. Thank you. All right. So our next paper is Characteristics and Receipt of Medical Treatment Among Young Adults Who Experience Non-Fatal Opioid-Related Overdose. And the lead author here is Sarah Bagley. So these authors sought to describe the characteristics of young adults who experience non-fatal overdose and sought to describe how many of them sought and underwent treatment afterwards. They conducted a retrospective cohort study of individuals in Massachusetts aged 18 to 45 who had non-fatal overdose between January 1st, 2012 and December 31st, 2014. They examined the Massachusetts Chapter 55 database, which is a database that tracks patients experiencing opiate overdose over time. To enter this cohort, individuals had to experience a non-fatal overdose in the enrolled time period mentioned above in Massachusetts, in any of the Massachusetts emergency departments. Each individual contributed to only his or her first non-fatal overdose in this enrollment period. Non-fatal overdoses were identified in two ways. Either the individual had to have an ambulance encounter related to an opiate overdose, or an emergency department encounter with an ICD-9 code for opiate poisoning. They then divided the cohort into three age groups, 18 to 21, 22 to 25, 26 to 45. And they wanted to see if the amount of patients who received medical assistance following their non-fatal overdose was different between these age groups. So what did they find? Of the greater than 15,000 individuals age 18 to 45 with a non-fatal overdose who encountered medical care, about 28% were the young adults, so in the 18 to 25 age group. In the 12 months after a non-fatal overdose, about 35% of the entire cohort received some kind of medical treatment for their opiate overdose. Of the individuals age 18 to 21, so the younger group, about 28% of them received medical treatment. Of the individuals 22 to 25, 36% received medical treatment, so more. Though, when the authors performed a regression analysis, they found that the younger cohort were just as likely to receive medical treatment as their older counterparts. Similar to the previous studies we discussed, this data is based off a database, and to get into this database, you either had to have an ambulance called for opiate overdose, present to the ED, and be coded as an opiate overdose. And so it probably doesn't account for all the overdoses, and so we might miss some of them, which would obviously bias the data in some way or another. Additionally, this only looks at which patients receive treatment, and so it's unclear how many patients were offered treatment versus how many accepted and declined it. So again, it kind of biases the data somewhat. I think the big take-home message here is that offer medical treatment to everyone who presents to the ED following an opiate overdose, as there is no variables which predict who will accept treatment and who will not.
Yeah, I mean, it's good to see that in general, there's not like, especially like an ageism sort of discrimination against different age groups. It's interesting to see what proportion received treatment at different times and how many months it took really for them to get some treatment. Actually, it was kind of interesting over the course of a year. And that kind of nicely segues into our next article, because our next article, this one is predictors of overdose death among high-risk emergency department patients with substance-related encounters, a data linkage cohort study. Lead author Noah Krivicek at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. And as we were just discussing, there's a number of people who do go on to receive treatment, and there's been a greater push recently to increase the number of patients receiving treatment and specifically using the emergency department to start medically assisted therapy. The question is, with all these people presenting to the emergency department with non-fatal overdoses, is there a certain subpopulation that is at the highest risk, either for initiation of medical assisted therapy or for even more than that, getting them into additional programs or additional follow-up? So this one is a retrospective cohort, as you've probably experienced here in the last three articles. This one from an administrative database in Maryland from 2014 to 2015 that was subsequently linked with all fatal overdose deaths in the state from 2015 to 2016. They were able to identify 1,250,000 patients with an emergency department encounter and link these to 963 overdose deaths, and specifically with 139,000 patients whose ED encounter was for substance use disorder or overdose. After going through all of these different predictors that they gathered as far as demographics, the big predictors that they came up with were multiple encounters for non-fatal overdose, with heroin abuse being the highest predictor, but really any encounter, including non-opioid overdoses, increased the risks. There are lots and lots of features that just generally slightly increase the risk, which included the substance abuse disorders and mental health disorders, but they did not rise to quite the level of multiple non-fatal overdoses. But unfortunately, even though these are big predictors, the absolute numbers are still very small. For instance, heroin, there were 4,000 non-fatal overdoses, but only 167 subsequent overdose deaths, even though this was one of the strongest predictors of future overdose death. So it's difficult to target a public health intervention when the vast majority do not go on to an overdose death. Another issue is generalizability. There was a big jump in fentanyl-related deaths after being otherwise basically stable during this conduct of this study. If you take fentanyl out of the equation, the risk of death goes down dramatically, as likely does this big risk association with heroin. So we've got a couple different descriptive pieces here. Still trying to figure out exactly who the best people to treat with medically assisted therapy is, but a good foundation for future research and policy.
Yeah, I mean, a couple things here. The actual risk of deaths was much lower in this study than the other two cohorts we looked at earlier. I think that was partly the patients they included overall, which seemed to, they included more than just non-fatal opioid deaths in their cohort. And so, you know, a greater denominator might have watered down the actual mortality rate. I do think, you know, if you take all these studies in a conglomeration and look at them all, it kind of shows that we don't really have a great predictor on, you know, who's a low risk group that we shouldn't be offering medical assisted therapy to versus a high risk group. So I think, you know, someone comes in with a non-fatal opioid death, they should probably be offered medical assisted therapy. That's the simplest way of diluting this down.
Oh, I certainly don't disagree with that. It's just some places have, you know, finite resources and there's not an infinite number of, you know, follow-up interventions. If you start somebody on buprenorphine most of the time, you know, it's nice to connect them with some additional resources, and those additional resources are going to be in limited supply just by the nature of our public health system. You know, if you've got somebody who's got multiple overdoses, certainly you need to get them connected at the highest risk levels. If you've got somebody who's, you know, their first overdose, I mean, it's just a matter of triage, unfortunately, because we don't have the resources to treat everybody. So that's where you end up talking about things where, like, well, we had 4,000 heroin overdoses, only a fraction go on to, you know, a tiny fraction go on to overdose death. How many resources do we devote to each individual heroin non-fatal overdose?
I think this data basically shows you can't. Yeah, it's obviously, you can say someone who has multiple overdoses is at higher risk than someone who comes in for a single opiate overdose, but both of them are at high enough risk they should receive therapy.
Yes, no argument there. Just a matter of, you know, you probably see this in your system too. You know, you refer somebody to some sort of detoxification clinic, and there's just literally no. There's no availability.
Sure.
Whether I don't know who's responsible necessarily for triaging those, but you know, from the emergency department, this is just a research that provides the guidance to develop those policies. Not necessarily, you know, we are not going to tell you exactly what the answer can be on this podcast.
No, but I think, you know, medical assisted therapy is the answer, and you know, from a structural standpoint, eliminating many of the barriers that have to be jumped through to get a patient to medical assisted therapy is probably the way to go. So it takes less resources to do so, right? I mean, you know, get rid of the X waiver, so on and so forth.
Oh yes, for sure. I mean, eliminating the barriers and providing access to a greater number of people, and then, you know, find a new problem to solve, and then find the next problem to solve, and then just keep on going down the, you know, the sequence, and using this information to either, you know, triage people or change resource allocation, and then interesting, you know, data from other, you know, which other emergency department encounters also have subsequent overdose risks. The more treatment, the better.
All right, why don't we move on? We'll move on to our pediatric portion of our podcast.
Yeah, switching gears to something somehow entirely different, yet just as painful. So this is entitled Pediatric Out-of-Hospital Traumatic Cardiopulmonary Arrest After Traffic Accidents and Termination of Resuscitation. Lead author here is Kita Shibahashi, and the institution is the Tokyo Metropolitan Bokuto Hospital. So, is there a reasonable predictive rule that can be applied to traumatic pediatric out-of-hospital arrest? That is the question asked by these authors. And this is a prospective trauma database collected in Japan between 2012 and 2016. They were able to capture 582 pediatric out-of-hospital arrests related to trauma. 20 survived, 8 of which were neurologically intact. And then they looked back and specifically looking at the CPR intervals, and they found that everyone who had a favorable neurologic outcome had spontaneous return of circulation prior to transport, and all of those who were neurointact had return of circulation within 15 minutes. So these authors tie this back to the adult guidelines that we have from the American College of Surgeons that state that termination of resuscitation is reasonable after 15 minutes of appropriate field treatment, including minimally interrupted CPR. And they say that these data would support the same being extended to pediatric patients. Now, unavoidably, this is a small sample size and, unfortunately, and also unavoidably small number of survivors upon which to base these conclusions. There were additional survivors with longer CPR duration, but they were not cerebral performance category 1 or 2 at the end. You know, this is a dismal survival rate and an even more dismal neurologically intact survival rate. And even though there's only a handful of children here, it probably is predictive and has face validity, especially when you add it to the sort of the Bayesian construct from the adult data. So I think these authors have a very reasonable conclusion about what you could probably put into your EMS policies for pediatric resuscitation in trauma.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, the sample size is a little worrying to kind of base this on, but...
8 children, you know.
8 children. So if you actually look at it, though, I mean, almost all of them, if they were going to survive, it was in the first 4 minutes that they got RUSC, and it was like the first 2 minutes that you got the majority of them back. And so that makes me actually question, were they actually dead in the first place, or did someone just not feel a pulse? Because if you look at these, you know, they were all PA arrests. No one's got shocked out of an electrically unstable rhythm.
It's pediatrics, and nobody should be in an electrically unstable rhythm in pediatrics unless it's trauma. A medical arrest that's being conflated with a traumatic arrest.
Sure, and it's trauma. And so, you know, what did they actually do? You know, none of the things that someone's going to die from
at
trauma.
At the first pulse check, they had pulses, and they ever really lose pulses? Yeah, there's questions like that from any of these sort of data sets, you know. But
so, you know, is there actually any cases that they got back or true cardiac arrest? It's a little bit unclear. That being said, I mean, there is face validity that if you're 15 minutes into a code and you don't have a better answer, it's probably okay to call the code, though, you know, this is a sick kid. And let's say you have ultrasound and you have a pericardial fusion and an active heart. Would that have changed things? Because none of that was looked at here, right? So should we stop transfer for all these kids after 15 minutes of cardiac arrest based on this one data set? I probably couldn't say yes.
No, I mean, again, that's the argument. I mean, you don't have that many kids. Are you ever going to get better data on kids? Are you going to transport all these kids and continue resuscitation? You know, at least it's a fairly small number of, you know, pediatric out-of-hospital arrests that you're going to end up transporting. But, you know, if you have to make, again, decisions about taking ambulances out of service and transporting patients and so on and so forth, you know, if you have to make decisions, then you have to make a decision of some sort about what your threshold's going to be, you know, adopting the adult guidelines or, you know, even extending them a little bit. You know, these are reasonable things you could do if you're designing EMS policy. And this data set is, you know, not useless. I mean, as there are a lot of children who don't survive, and you have a lot of data who don't, on the ones who don't survive because they never get ROSC. So,
yeah, I mean, as far as we can tell, all the patients who truly had a cardiac arrest died. It's a little unclear if any of them actually survived. No. And that's probably because they had non-survival, lots of brain damage, right? Like, so non-survivable massive brain injury is probably the vast majority of these. They don't actually say that, but that's probably the case. And so you're right. In the majority of patients, no ROSC in 15 minutes, it's probably safe to stop. But can you truly say that with pediatric population? I don't think you quite can with this data set alone. All right, so our next article, characterization of in-flight medical events involving children on commercial airline flights, and the lead author is Alexander Rota. So nothing is scarier than taking care of a sick kid, except maybe taking care of a sick kid 40,000 feet in the air with none of your medical supplies and none of your nurses or techs or anyone else to help you. But these authors thought to characterize in-flight medical events experienced by children worldwide. They conducted a retrospective review of a prospectively collected database from a center which provides remote medical support to approximately 35% of the worldwide commercial airline passenger traffic. They included data on calls to the ground-based medical support center triggered by in-flight medical events involving passengers younger than 19 years of age during the study period. They essentially reviewed the records associated with these calls, characterized the reason of the call, the in-flight disposition, and whether there was a need for additional care at the destination, and whether the aircraft had to be diverted. During the study period, the Ground Medical Support Center received about 75,000 unique calls because of in-flight emergencies. Among these, about 11,000 or 15.5% were involved pediatric passengers and were included in this analysis. The cases originated from a pool of 77 different airlines over six continents. The youngest subject involved in an in-flight medical emergency was 25 days, and the oldest was 18 years. The median age was 7, and the split between boys and girls was about 50-50. About 16.5% of these patients required additional care at the destination. The most common diagnosis categories included nausea, vomiting, fever and chills, acute allergic reaction, abdominal pain, gastroenteritis, syncope, and seizures. This list was slightly different for LAP infants, where the most common diagnosis was fever, vomiting, blunt trauma. I mean, were people dropping their infants
turbulence,
in the plane?
Turbulence, Rory. Scary.
Respiratory distress and seizures. Now, here's the scary part. 11 patients had the primary diagnostic category of cardiopulmonary arrests with a median age of 2 years old. Automated external defibrillator was applied to 11 of these patients, and none of them had a shockable rhythm. Aircraft diversion occurred in 63 instances, and there were 11 in-flight deaths, which makes me didn't actually say it, but were the 11 cardiac arrests related to the 11 in-flight deaths. So none of them survived. That's a little daunting. The authors go on to perform a logistic regression in which they found that in-flight medical events involving LAP infants were significantly associated with a need for additional care at the destination, as were those with patients who had syncope, seizure, burns, dyspnea, blunt trauma, lacerations, or had issues associated with congenital heart disease. Children seen by a medical professional on board the flight, who was an other passenger, were also more likely to receive additional care at the destination, which is not surprising. Factors significantly associated with in-flight diversions included seizures, arrhythmias, or cardiopulmonary arrest, all of which seemed reasonable, the use of oxygen or automated defibrillator, and the number of time zones crossed in the original flight plan. You know, this is a fascinating article, and it's the largest article that we have on this topic, so it's a really great read. I would have liked to know a little more about the 11 cardiac arrests. Did these kids have extensive past medical histories, like some known cardiac abnormality or such? All in all, I think it's a really great analysis. I think it reveals what I think most of us know, that most of the time, pediatric in-flight emergencies are minor and require a little intervention, but every once in a while, they can be terrifying. The discussion section of this article is also really chock full of useful information regarding the logistics of in-flight medical emergencies, including Table 4, which is a lift of the FFA mandatory first aid kits, which I recommend everyone comes over and takes a look at.
Yeah, it's an interesting descriptive study. It's a little bit limited by, it's essentially the calls that come into this one place, this commercial facility in Phoenix, Arizona. Because you can tell basically that the generalizability is related to the length of the flight. This is all long haul flights. These are the people who are calling about the medical emergencies. But, for what it's worth, the medical emergencies are probably similar in nature in short and medium haul flights. But if you've got, long haul flights, that's going to be your most miles traveled. That's going to end up being the bulk of your airline miles carrying children that are going to develop a medical emergency is just based on, simple math. So it's just fascinating to see that just as much as the when they had that published that sort of descriptive study of adult medical emergencies a couple years back, it's typical stuff that you would see in a pediatric emergency department. But most of us don't see kids on the sick kids on a frequent basis. So seeing a sick kid in a flying tube 20,000 feet in the air could be certainly very stressful.
It's less than ideal, Ryan. Less than ideal.
Less than ideal. Is that the medical term for it?
All right. Well, why don't we move on?
And we're still in pediatric land, so we'll move to a different topic, though. This next one is a cool running water first aid decreases skin grafting requirements in pediatric burns, a cohort study of 2,495 children. Lead author is Bronwyn R. Griffin, and they are at the Queensland University of Technology Faculty of Health. So the article, pretty title much says it all. What's the first treatment for a burn? Keeping it cool and moist. What's a great way to do that? If safe and possible, cool running water. So the guidelines, there's actually guidelines about this, but there's still some ambiguity on how long to run underwater. In the United States, they say at least 5 minutes, but in Europe and Australia, they say 20 minutes. So who's correct? Well, let's find out. And this is a prospective registry documenting pediatric burn patient outcomes. And unfortunately, here's the first issue with that registry, is that the data regarding the first aid provided initially after the burn comes from parental and patient recall at the first burn clinic visit after discharge from the emergency department. That being said, the parents were asked to recall whether the patient received no first aid, an alternative to cool running water, or a specific duration of cool running water lasting either less than 5 minutes, 5 to 10 minutes, 11 to 19 minutes, or greater than or equal to 20 minutes, which they called adequate therapy. They had 2,495 patients, mostly scalds and contact burns, most of which involved the upper extremity, most of which were less than 5% body surface area, and they were mostly the second degree, superficial or deep partial thickness burns. 90% of the people who followed up in their clinic had their burns treated with cool running water, 70% for the guideline recommended 20 minutes. Overall, 9.5% needed skin grafting. Throughout their various regression analyses, obviously, full thickness burns were at the highest risk for skin grafting and operating room involvement. But this lack of adequate first aid, cool running water durations of less than 20 minutes, remained an independent predictor of grafting. And, you know, this seems reasonable. Interestingly, they actually talk about some animal models, and it's not like you can just do two, you know, 5 minutes is bad, 10 minutes is better, 20 minutes is even better, 30 minutes or 40 minutes, an hour, where do you stop? Actually, they said that there are some animal models out there where the yield of benefits seems to decrease over 30 minutes, where possible harms from hypothermia and vasoconstriction outweigh the benefit of the cooled running water. So I figure this is whenever this is feasible and unlikely to result in other harms, it seems as though 20 minutes is a good target.
There is no way this is accurate. Like,
I don't mean, like the parental recall at the 1 week.
Parental recall, and you're telling me that 20 minutes is better than 19 minutes? That 1 minute really makes a difference. And like,
I said it was a good target. I didn't say it was a mandatory quality measure.
I get it. And like, you know, the harms here are probably minimal. So if you can run cold water over a burn for 20 minutes, do so. But this is so confounded. This has got to be.
If it's feasible and unlikely to result in other harms. But, you know, I mean, 5 minutes, okay. I mean, talking about like a Bayesian prior, if you're basing it on animal models whose skin is pretty similar to humans, I mean, it's not like, you know, okay, we're saying in mice, you know, but like skin is mostly preserved across species. If you have an animal model that shows that there's increasing risk, you know, likelihood of a good outcome with longer durations of cool running water up to a certain limit, and if you replicate that in humans, you're probably on the right track.
Yeah, I just think there's so much confounding here. I mean, this is probably related to the feeling of care that the patient received overall during their burn treatment, you know.
How does that tie to skin grafting? This is actual objective outcome, operative intervention in skin grafting, not like how much does it hurt?
You know, no, but you know, the parents' recall of how much water was run on the patient during their presentation.
That is by far the biggest limitation. I mean, it's like garbage in, garbage out. You know, if you don't have reliable data going in, or, you know, then you don't have any idea. And you're saying that the recall is going to be changed based on how the patient's progressing. So there is some of that recall bias as well. So, you know, these are all excellent points. But if you're going to flip it around and try and defend 5 minutes over 20 minutes, this makes it hard. I mean, you could just say, don't, you know, discount this whole article. 5 minutes is better. I mean, this is one of those things where it's probably reasonable, you know, if it's not going to cause other harms and it's feasible, get close to 20.
Sure. But if you have a really sick burn who's in shock and needs to be intubated and transferred to a burn center, maybe running their part of their burn underwater for 20 minutes is not the first priority.
Well, let's also be very clear. This article does not include that patient. These are the less than 5% body surface. These are kids who touched something hot on the stove or pulled something down onto them. You know, they got something, they got run under cold water and discharged this outpatient follow-up. The patient that you're talking about, house fire, you know, car crash, I don't know, that we're not running those patients. You're going to drape that patient in cool, you know, whatever, you know, cool soaked towels or something like that, you know, but you're not going to be able to run them underwater.
All right. I think we've come home. We've come up with a take home message, which is, if you have the time, 20 minutes is reasonable. But I'm going to say, when someone does a randomized trial comparing 5 minutes to 10 minutes to 20 minutes, there's going to be no difference.
There's going to be a beautiful curve of response. But again, you're going to have such a rare outcome, skin grafting, 9%, you know, it's like, it's going to be so hard. The confidence interval is so wide, you know, it's going to be so difficult to measure a difference between the two. But again, how about a catchier slogan? Like, get wet is the best bet for longer than 5 minutes. All right. Moving on.
All right. Yes. Speaking of unwarranted mandates, our final article here is antibiotic delays and feasibility of a 1 hour from triage antibiotic requirement, an analysis of an emergency department sepsis quality improvement database. And the lead author is Michael Philbin. So in 2018, the Surviving Sepsis Campaign unveiled their new 1 hour bundle, which the general intent was to take everything in the 3 hour bundle that the ED was already having difficulty being compliant with and stuff it into a 1 hour bundle. There was a fairly loud outcry from the emergency medicine community because there really isn't any good quality evidence that time to antibiotic therapy or the rest of the bundle matters except for the sickest of the sick patients. And many recognize the potential unintended harms such a guideline would cause on emergency departments across the country as they were forced to spray waiting rooms with broad spectrum antibiotics and 30 cc's per kg of fluid.
Spray waiting rooms with 30 cc's of fluid. Yes.
I mean, that's the only way you're going to get this accomplished. But
you've got a decon shower for all patients with a fever.
Yeah. But let's look at the data, why don't we? So these authors examined just how feasible the 1 hour bundle really was. They conducted a retrospective examination of all adult patients greater than 18 over a 2 year period who met criteria adapted from the current SEP 1 definition for sepsis and septic shock. Halfway through this interval, the CD initiated a sepsis care quality improvement intervention, which included triage screening rule and then basically a protocol to administer 30 cc's per kg and the appropriate IV antibiotics. So over this time, they had a total of 654 patients enrolled, 297 in the pre-intervention group and 357 during following the quality improvement intervention. Rates of antibiotic delay were significantly reduced from pre to post quality improvement measure. That's good, but let's actually look at the numbers. If you used the 3 hour SEP 1 bundle, noncompliance with getting antibiotics in 3 hours happened about 30% pre implementation of the quality improvement measure versus 21% afterwards. If you look at the surviving sepsis 1 hour bundle, delays to antibiotics occurred in 85% of the patients pre-quality improvement and 71% post-quality improvement. And of course, there was no difference in actual clinical outcomes between the two cohorts. So, you know, there's the usual limitations with a retrospective study, before and after study. Most importantly, are there any unmeasured differences between these two groups? Did some other factors occur over this time period that affected the results? And of course, this is a single center study. So would a sepsis screening tool and protocol have the same effect at other facilities? We're not so sure. That being said, even if these numbers represent the perfect effects of a quality improvement initiative such as this, the effects are modest at best. I mean, look at this. Even with this Herculean effort, 71% of these patients still did not receive antibiotics within the 1 hour time frame. Because for the most part, this is impossible. As we said earlier, you'd have to spray the waiting room with inhaled tobramycin to meet this criteria. I think actually the biggest limitation of this paper is it only looks at the patients that ended up with the final diagnosis of sepsis. In doing so, they eliminated all the patients who screened positive for sepsis but did not end up having sepsis. How many patients got needless antibiotics or received unnecessary 30 cc per kg fluid boluses? What happened to all the other patients in the ED while we are rushing to get antibiotics into these patients who may or may not be septic? I get it. Sick patients in septic shock, we need to move fast. No one's arguing this, but creating a criteria which encourages screening of broad populations to potentially catch a few patients who will benefit and are likely clinically obvious in the first place will only do more harm than good.
Yeah, and I mean, you look at, it's a little hard to read into some of these things, but you look at what they're basing this on, this spot sepsis rule, which is basically SIRS, you know, it's like tachycardia, hypotension, and like infectious, vague infectious symptoms with comorbidities. I mean, you can just imagine that they're capturing so many people into this rule to be evaluated for, you know, rapid antibiotics. I mean, short of doing code stroke, like sort of things like code sepsis overhead with the whole team assembling for something that's going to be presenting with such increasing frequency relative to our, you know, an actual, you know, cerebrovascular ischemia. This is a lot of effort to address something that has no proven association with downstream outcomes, except for what you said, the sickest of the sick. You're not going to save somebody's mortality from their strep throat, from their urinary tract infection, from their cellulitis, you know, mild cellulitis. You know, it's the patient who is hypotensive, is tachycardic and immunosuppressed. There's so many patients that a few minutes delay doesn't change anything, yet the unintended consequences of something like this are almost guaranteed to cause harms.
Yeah, I mean, it's humongous. And I think they're going about it all the wrong way. Like most of these screening criteria, the intent is to identify every patient that may possibly be septic. And as you said, you end up treating strep throat with broad spectrum vancomycin and giving them 30 cc's of IV fluid when they could, you know, drink a cup of water. But in reality, we should be devising a screening protocol that identifies the few patients that actually would benefit from timely aggressive care.
Yeah, I mean, it's either whether it involves markers of, you know, immunosuppression like transplant patients, or, you know, diabetics with poorly controlled blood sugars or something like that, or previous admissions. I mean, we have so much more sophisticated things that we can deploy based on the electronic health record that just going to, and saying, you know, you're tachycardic and you have, you know, some sort of infectious symptom. I mean, I know antibiotics won't help our coronavirus patients. I hope we're still laughing about this next month. This is going to be interesting.
Yeah, we'll see.
Oh, my.
Yeah, I think the take-home message here is the one-hour bundle is unreasonable and unrealistic. And, you know, if this is adopted as a performance measure, it's going to put a lot of unneeded burden on the emergency department.
Oh, well, I mean, that's not really a fair conclusion to make from these data. A one-hour bundle is totally reasonable and can be implemented, but there's no way that you can actually be a good doctor and still do it. Because these people are clearly trying to still be good doctors and, you know, like, assess their patients and make sure they're treating just the right people. But, I mean, you could slam in antibiotics on anybody within an hour and hit these goals. And you could just make it a nursing-initiated order set. You don't have to have a doctor involved if you want to hit these, you know, markers.
I don't know. They tried, and they certainly tried, and they still failed in 71% of the patients.
Well, yeah, I mean, to some extent, I mean, you get the limitations of your emergency department's, you know, volume, but yeah, I mean, again, one center, one experience, you know, but hopefully this doesn't turn